Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com. His face floods with light and relief. You have won second prize in a beauty contest. Collect £10. Monopoly, first invented as the landlord's game in 1903, endlessly reimagined and reinterpreted ever since. Welcome to The Rest is History, with the Old Kent Road of History, Tom Holland, and with me, Mr. Mayfair, Dominic Sandbrook. Hello, Tom. You're a big Monopoly fan?
What a wonderful introduction. You've won the game of The Rest is History already.
I have. We should stop right now. It'll be downhill from there. So today's subject is a huge one, actually, isn't it? It's history as entertainment, history as board games, video games. And I thought we'd go in first with reenactments, because that's obviously something that you know a lot about, because you've written about it in the past. And we had a question, didn't we, from Roland Miners, who says, I seem to remember the Romans did battle reenactments as part of their games. So we're always told that the stadiums could be flooded for sea battles. And he says, was this a bit of theming for gladiators to kill each other, or was this actual reenactment of history? And I guess for as long as there's been history, Tom, people have reenacted it, right?
Yeah, well, people probably remember in Gladiator that Russell Crowe plays the part of the Carthaginians in the Battle of Zama, where the Carthaginians lost to the Romans, but in Gladiator they win, which, of course, is part of the fun of reenacting history, isn't it? I mean, it's part of the fun of staging these, is that occasionally you get different results. So we obviously, the Romans would have exercised some control over that. So we know, for instance, that after Claudius conquers Britain, he restages his capture of Colchester. There was no question that the Britons were going to win that. Obviously, the Romans had to win it. But yes, I think you do get the sense. We know that Claudius also sponsored a great naval battle in which I think the Rhodians and the Syracusans fought each other. And I think that's a bit more like those kind of computer games where you can get the Aztecs fighting the Babylonians or something. You know, you bring people, different people to fight each other. And of course, in the style of armor that the gladiators wore, so that you had a type called the Samnite, which was a central Italian people defeated by the Romans, kind of, you know, in the 3rd century BC. And then you have Thracians, who were another kind in northern Greece. And I think there was the sense with gladiatorial combat that it was about reminding the Romans of their own history, of their martial qualities. You know, Rome is this city at the heart of a great peaceful empire. So people did slightly worry that they were forgetting their martial values. So there was, I think, a sense in which gladiatorial combat existed to remind the Romans of their ancient martial history. I think you could count that as historical reenactment to a degree.
And sort of telling history in itself is a reenactment, isn't it? I mean, the weird thing about history is that, you know, you're sort of performing it when you retell it on the page. And there's always this issue with history, or, you know, we get a lot of comments on Twitter about, you know, to what extent is history social science, or to what extent is it a kind of literary entertainment? And entertainment is kind of baked into history from the beginning, isn't it? With Herodotus and so on. And people read that stuff because it's fun and because they want to have
fun.
I
think,
right?
But you think also, though, that baked into it is a kind of, when you read something about the past, you can feel this yearning to see it for yourself.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And so, you know, so we talked about Arthur. We talked about King Arthur and the Round Table at Winchester, which almost certainly was built to mark an attempt by knights under Edward I to recreate Camelot. And that was something, you know, so that was a theme in tournaments throughout the Middle Ages, was that people would come dressed as, you know, Galahad or Lancelot or whatever. And it was a kind of desire to make real this world of romance that people believed, you know, had actually happened.
They had a sense, as we do, of a kind of lost world that they can never recapture. Yeah. And they wanted, and glamour. They think that the past is glamorous. Do they?
Yes. And then, of course, famously, there was an attempt to recreate the tournament in the 19th century after Queen Victoria's coronation, which lots of people felt had been rather drab. And they got rid of this kind of tradition where the champion of the queen comes in and challenges someone to single combat if they're not going to accept her as queen. And so the Duke of Eglinton set up this tournament in Ayrshire, which, of course, it rained.
Of course.
Surprising. So it was all in that absolute kind of washout. But that's kind of brilliant, that whole kind of Victorian strain of cod medievalism.
Yeah.
Which was hugely influential on architecture and all kinds of things. But it was, you know, they did actually try and stage a tournament. And I guess that is absolutely something that goes into the 20th century, because, of course, the more that you have a consumer society, the more you have money that you can spend on recreating this kind of stuff, the more people do it.
Yes. And I suppose I remember having a conversation once with a guy called Ian Mortimer, who writes these books called The Time Traveller's Guide to a Particular Period. And he'll write about history as though it's a guidebook. You know, this is where you stay, this is where you eat. And it was about the question of history as entertainment. And sometimes it's easy to forget, I think, when you're a sort of academic historian, engaged in historiographical arguments with your peers, that actually the reason people get into history, and the reason actually people are listening to this podcast, is because it's fun. It's because there's something.
You're saying this podcast is fun?
Well, I think I'm having fun anyway, even if nobody else is. But, you know, there's that sense that you're interested in history, not just because it's instructive. I mean, we've done a whole podcast about the lessons of history, but because, as you said, there is this sort of insatiable, literally insatiable yearning to see people who've been before us and to see their world that is completely out of reach. And that's why people will always do these kind of reenactments and things.
But when it comes to reenactment, there is actually a kind of border zone, isn't it, where it becomes living history. And people will say that if you want to understand something, you actually have to experience it. So about 5 years ago, talking on the subject of medieval tournaments and recreating them, I find generally when you go to, you know, they recreate them at National Trust, I find incredibly dull because they're just staged. But about 5 years ago, I went to I think it's called officially called medieval warfare or something, and it's kind of like a sport, and they staged it at this castle Belmonte in La Mancha in the middle of Spain, which is where they filmed El Cid, the Charlton Heston film. And they have this huge international tournament. It's kind of like the World Cup. They had teams from America and Britain and Germany all around the world. And I thought it was going to, again, be really dull. It was brilliant. It was absolutely fantastic. So what the rules are that they have a kind of like a football pitch, I guess, and you're not allowed to go outside the football pitch. And you map up, you know, 1-on-1, 5-on-5. The climax was 100-on-100.
100 people. I mean, that's a proper battle.
Oh, it was really, really brilliant. It was one of the great sporting events that I've ever been to. And the rule is essentially that you can smack anyone around the head you like. You know, you don't have a sword, you don't have anything sharp, but you have kind of blunt axes or maces or whatever. And you can just smack people. And as long as they are on 2 feet, the battle continues. The moment they touch anything else, so with their hand or their elbow or their head or whatever, then they're out. And
wow.
It was amazing. And the argument for this being educational was that the better your armor, the better you are able to stand up. So I spoke to the captain of the German team who I think he was a travel agent, but in his spare time, he'd go around chapels and churches all around Germany looking at, effigies of knights in armor.
But he's looking for tips.
It was such fun. But also the other brilliant thing about that was that it was also very, very political, because I think that this sport had been begun by the Russians, and the Russians were apparently rather aggressive. And so they'd been frozen out by all the other countries.
Wow.
And in fact, I think some of the people who were involved in that then went on to take part in the invasion of Crimea.
That's interesting. Yeah. Which is itself a kind of reenactment of Tsarist glory. You know, I mean, yes, to what extent are politicians? Is Boris Johnson a kind of Churchill reenactment act? I mean, I suppose you can argue reenactment is baked into politics itself. But on the politics, that's a really interesting thing, because have you ever been to this place in France called Puy du Fou, which is this one of Europe's most popular theme parks, which is all about history?
No, I've been to the Asterix park.
I've never been to the Asterix one, but the Puy du Fou one is fascinating, because it has a series of zones. There's one about the Vikings. There's one about, there's a couple about the Middle Ages. They have, which you would love, they have a Roman amphitheater. I mean, they have an amphitheater where they have shows with chariot racing, gladiatorial battles and wild animals. It says in the brochure they have executions, but I don't believe that can be true. But it's massively popular in this place. They get hundreds of thousands, millions of people. It's the second most visited theme park in France after Disneyland. And what's interesting about it is it's set up by a politician who was originally Mitterrand's culture minister, Philippe de Villiers, who's now very right-wing, very anti-Islam, anti-immigration, kind of an unashamed French nationalist, conservative. And the version of history that you get is kind of pure Kings and Battles. It's a kind of the French equivalent of Our Island Story. So the stuff about Richelieu's musketeers, they have a thing about the Battle of Verdun from World War One, and it is colossally popular. I mean, it's hard to imagine.
Have you been to that?
I haven't actually. I'm talking about it I was going to go before COVID. My son is desperate to go, and every now and again, to amuse ourselves during lockdown, we would watch videos, you know, in that sort of terrible
of
sort
executions.
Of third-hand tourist way. We'd watch YouTube videos of other people who've been and sort of weeped that we can't go ourselves. I mean, it looks amazing, but I was thinking, could you do it in a less right-wing way? I mean, could you do a left-wing history theme park? And I'm not sure would if they did a sort of Peterloo reenactment and a thing about the Chartists. I mean, Tony Benn would like, but they have Level a Day in Burford, which is a kind of big reenactment. I mean, it's a reenactment as in people turn up with posters and shout about John Lilburn or something.
Well, I mean, there's a sealed knot, isn't there? Which is, I think
I can see you as a sealed knot.
50 years old now.
Have you done the sealed knot? I bet you've done the sealed knot, haven't you?
I remember, I've never actually taken part in it. I always have secret yearning.
You'd be a cavalier though, wouldn't you?
I'd be an Ironside.
Would you? I'd be an Ironside. I'd love to
be an Ironside.
I'd like to be Cromwell's spymaster or something? That's what I'd want to do.
Milton, perhaps. Just sit there being blind.
Yeah.
Writing, read stuff in Latin. There was a novel by a crime writer called Anthony Price, who almost I don't think anyone reads them anymore, but I really loved them. They were always crime stories, thrillers, espionage stories revolving around history. And he had one called War Game, which was set in the context of a battle, a kind of sealed knot type battle. And the gist in that was that everyone on the parliamentarian side was very much on the left, and everyone on the royalist side was very much on the right. And a very left-wing guy who's being shadowed by MI5 ends up dead in a ditch with a halberd through his stomach.
Sounds great.
And it was great. I remember it being great. And then it kind of, you know, turned out to be a big conspiracy theory. But I was kind of wondering whether, I guess that... you know, if you're on the left, you would be probably drawn to the roundheads. And if you're on the right, to
you would,
cavaliers. Because I looked up the sealed knot, because I thought we'd probably end up talking about it. And it says the name of the society derives from a group which during the Protectorate plotted for the restoration of the monarchy. So it's a cavalier society. But it's very... Here the similarity ends, as the present society, and this is in capitals on the website, is non-political and has no political affiliation or ambitions. So it seems it's very important for the sealed knot to make that clear.
I can believe that of them, but at the same time, I think there probably is something temperamentally small because he's conservative about being a reenactor. Don't you think? I mean, if you're super left wing, you probably think what you want to do is build a better tomorrow rather than go back to yesterday and sort of put on a nice hat and stuff, which I think is, I'm not saying there's something inherently conservative about hats, but there kind of is there, isn't there?
Definitely. Yes, particularly if they've got feathers in.
Yeah, but see, I'd want to dress up as Stanley Baldwin or something, so it would probably be
Of course. Well, I think that's a massive money spinner. I think you should go ahead with that.
Yeah.
Well, because at the furthest extremes, you really are pushing into some quite dodgy areas. So
Prince Harry. Prince Harry.
Well, yes, so Prince Harry dressing up as Nazis. So dressing up as Nazis is...
It's verboten, as it were.
So there was a congressman, Rich Ayatt, about 10 years ago, I think. He was he was running for Congress, and his candidature got torpedoed because it turned out that he was a reenactor, and among the reenactments that he'd done, he dressed up in SS uniform.
I think that's hard to come back from that.
So dressing up in an SS uniform, I think, I mean, that's, you're pushing the... pushing the boat out there.
The claim that people always make, isn't it, is they just like the uniform. But yeah, it's there's a slight "are we the baddies" aspect to it that I think is hard to overcome, don't you?
So I was wondering in that context, I don't know the answer to this, what the state of play is at the moment with the reenactment of battles in the American Civil War, because I know that that's a huge scene in America.
I mean, they make the Sealed Lot look like amateurs. I mean, they are amateurs, but you know what I mean. They it's huge. But I wonder whether that kind of buys into a subject that we should do in a separate podcast, which is the lost cause of the Confederacy. So lots of people love to. I mean, the fascination with the Civil War, I think, often does have a sort of political dimension to it in America, rather like that whole ecosystem of plantations and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, I mean, it would be hard as an outsider. I mean, maybe American listeners will disagree and will put us right. But as an outsider, I think there's an element when you're pulling on a Confederate uniform in defense of slavery. I mean, I know some people will say, oh, no, states' rights or whatever, but obviously slavery is a big part of it. That it does feel very highly charged at the moment, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, there's a big controversy here in Britain about the National Trust and to what extent visitors should be told about whether people who owned it or built it or whatever, whether they were making their money from slavery. And I was wondering what the state of play is with the grand plantations in Beaufort or.
Well, I've been to a plantation. I went to a plantation called Boone Hall. We were shown around by this Scarlett O'Hara like vision, who, you know, took us through the kitchens and the lovely drawing room and the veranda and all this sort of stuff. But she didn't mention slavery once. And there was sort of a load of huts in the distance. And I said, what was going on in the huts? And she said, oh, that's like the staff quarters or something, you know. I mean, this was some years ago. I mean, maybe they've changed their rubric since then. But there was definitely a downplaying of the key element that you would think as a visitor would loom largest. And obviously, as a lot of listeners, I'm sure, will think there's something kind of really a bit tasteless about luxuriating in this world without drawing attention to its single most salient feature.
Or even, even something like the London Dungeon, where the emphasis is very much on torture and death and murder. Is Jack the Ripper?
Well, Jack the Ripper, we had Hallie Rubenhold on, didn't, and she's very vigorous in campaigning against what she sees as the Jack the Ripper industry, which is interesting because when I told my son, who's 9, that we were doing a podcast with her, and he said, is she going to tell us who killed Jack the Ripper? And I said, no, she's more into the women, the victims. And he said, who cares about the victims? I want to hear it. Would Sherlock Holmes have caught Jack the Ripper? And was Jack the Ripper a prince? Those are the two questions that everybody wants answered.
Well, the questions everyone wants. Yes, yes. Well, I mean, I suppose that the, if we, the things that tend to get reenacted are violent.
They are. They're always violent.
Whether it's Jack the Ripper in London Dungeons, or reenactment battles. You don't reenact people. To a degree you do, don't you? Occasionally there are attempts to, there's that village in Hampshire where they've rebuilt various huts from various periods of history. And you do get people who kind of sit around and weave and things, but it's less inherently dramatic.
It is less dramatic. And if you judge history as an industry more broadly, so you think about films, but also books. I mean, classically, what sells is the Second World War and the Tudors. And the fascination of the Tudors is that people have their heads cut off. I mean, that's what people like about the story. Yeah. It's not just about kind of gowns and Bibles.
Yes, it is about the execution.
The executioner's axe is key to the success. And we look now at gladiatorial games. I mean, we will have to do a podcast on gladiatorial games, but we look now at gladiatorial games with horror. I'm sure you would say because of our Christian heritage, and we recoil from the spectacle of the blood and all the rest of it. But we consume the blood, don't we? Vicariously. I mean, we're going to do video games in a second, but we consume it in the books. I mean, how many authors right now, how many historians are crafting a chapter in which 1,000 people die horribly?
Yeah.
And we're going to read it people are going to read it for entertainment, effectively.
Right. And you mentioned computer games and indeed board games. And an awful lot of those that have a kind of historical setting absolutely do involve lots and lots of people being killed. But it could be a counter moving across a board and you know, entire continents are conquered, or in a computer game, you storm a city or something. But let's get onto that after the break. Board yeah. games and computer games.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome back to The Rest is History. We're talking about history as entertainment, particularly games. And Dominic, you opened this episode by talking about Monopoly.
I did, yeah, shamelessly.
So Monopoly, is that strictly a game about history? Isn't it a game about capitalism?
It's a game about a particular version of capitalism. So it is a historically rooted game. So there are all sorts of arguments about the origins of Monopoly, but as far as we can tell, it began in about 1903, and it was an anti-capitalist game. It was what's called a Georgist game. So there was a guy called Henry George in America who had all these theories about landlordism, about fighting landlordism. So this is the progressive era in America, where people are sort of taming the excesses of capitalism, of the sort of Carnegie, you know, sort of the rampant railroad kind of American school of capitalism. And the point of Monopoly was to illustrate how bad landlordism is. So in other words, if you've got all this property, you can squeeze your tenants and you'll become rich and they will never win. That was the point of it, that you would never win if you didn't get all this, you know, you didn't get all this property. And then basically Monopoly evolved and there was a big battle over the patents for it. And it ended up being taken up by the sort of toy companies and turned into a capitalist game in the Depression. So it's no longer about showing you how evil it is. Now it's about glorying in your winnings. And obviously it's been very successful since then. But what's interesting is that it is the game that's permanently been reinterpreted politically. So there were Cold War kind of communist versions. And some of our listeners sent in, there was a version done by East German dissidents called Bureaucratopoly, which was mocking the East German system. And then the Hungarian communists, I mean, they had a version of their own called Budget Smartly. The actual title in Hungarian is Gazdal Kodj Okasan, has my Magyar.
We need Jonathan Wilson here to.
We do, yeah. He would be very good in this. He would put me right. There's no doubt about that. So, yeah, so Monopoly in itself is a great presumably are historians of Monopoly who see it as a sort of map of the 20th century.
Okay, so the implication of that is that it begins as an anti-capitalist board yeah. game, but very rapidly it becomes all about conquering your enemies and becoming as rich and powerful as possible.
Yeah, like most games.
And on that theme, we have a question from the splendidly named Dick of Axe. And he says, From civilization to risk to Europa Universalis, there is some irresistible urge in humans, it seems, to paint a map one color. Doesn't matter if you're playing a board game or if you're Roman Emperor. Do you agree? I mean, definitely. Yeah. When it comes to both the board games and computer games, historically themed games, by and large, do seem to involve an awful lot of conquest.
They are about conquest. Is there not? It's only just occurred to me, hearing that question, that surely the movement to decolonize board games can only be weeks away, right? Because, I mean, Risk, Diplomacy, all these kind of board games, they're all about creating empires, aren't they? And defeat and smiting your opponents. I mean, it's hard to imagine a game that didn't involve that, because that's the pleasure of games.
Well, even chess. I mean, chess is kind of replicating a battle, isn't it? Originally, it's chariots and... And even in the one we have now, it's kind of knights and things on battlefields. So risk is the classic example of that. So it's a global game.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the setting is supposedly Napoleonic.
But it's kind of a Cold War game, don't you think? You know, it's a sort of, or post-World War II game. It's a game. See, you're right. The setting is kind of older. But don't you think it the mindset is, you know, there are great blocks fighting each other for control of the world?
The cards show, you know, cuirassiers and Napoleonic infantrymen and things. But you're having to conquer the entire globe, and the map is the globe.
Yeah.
And that episode we did on the lessons of history, and we dwelt very strongly on don't invade Asia. And I remember I played Risk with my brother, who's since gone on, course, to host our sister pod about the Second World War, and very distinguished historian in the Second World War, and he would always invade Asia, and so I'd always win. I'd always kind of encourage him, say, "Aren't you going to invade Asia?" And he'd go, "Oh yes, I think I will." and I think that the trauma of that is what has led him to study the Second World War.
Wow, that's a terrible insight into your brother's psychology. But these games, seen now a few years ago, Neil Ferguson, who had a link up with the games company, he published articles saying that he was going to use this game in his teaching at Harvard, and that this game, I can't remember what game it was. I don't think it was a terribly successful game, actually, that he had collaborated with it, and that it was very useful for instructing you about how statecraft worked. And a lot of the time, for most historians, there were kind of guffaws of disbelief and sort of scorn. But I actually think games are an incredibly good way of, I mean, that's why the CIA and that's why, you know, the Pentagon do war games, because they think they're a good way of illustrating the different variables that condition, you know, success or failure in war and in diplomacy.
Okay. So you said diplomacy. I think diplomacy is the best. So that's
a pre-war
build up to the First World War.
Yeah.
It's the great powers of Europe. And the reason that's great is that you don't take it in turns to have turns. You all do it at the same time. And the opportunity to stab your allies in the back is tremendous. And I played it and stabbed my supposed ally in the back so successfully that I won triumphantly. And I've never played it since, because I know I can never top that.
That's great. But you see, you reveal your true self in a game, Tom, I think. So
yes, you do.
That's very worrying.
Yes.
But there's some amazing games. So who was it? Andrew Menkes suggested a game called The Campaign for North Africa. Now, this is an amazing game because it's a 70s game. It's colossally detailed. To play this game through, so it's the World War II North African campaign, to play it through, it takes an estimated 1,500 hours. And the game itself recommends
62 days.
The game recommends
62 days.
That on each side, you need five people, one of whom is the commander-in-chief and the other are subordinate commanders. And it's so complicated that if you're playing as the Italians, you need to bring water for your pasta to the battlefield.
Yes,
you know,
I love that. I love that. And apparently, I looked up an article on this. And apparently that rule isn't even factually accurate, because the guy who invented this game, he says, the reality is that the Italians cook their pasta with the tomato sauce that came with the cans.
Wow.
So he made it
up.
He's
done his research. Yeah. He's,
and the other amazing thing, he says, every game turn, 3% of your fuel evaporates unless you're the British before a certain date, because they used 50-gallon drums instead of jerry cans.
Oh, my God. See, there's a level of detail, isn't there? A friend of mine has a game called Twilight Struggle, which is a Cold War game. And he always, whenever we go to visit, he always says, you know, is this the moment where we're going to play this game? We've got kids, we've got wives. It's kind of hard to find the moment to say for the next 10 hours we'll be incommunicado.
But it's more than 10 hours, isn't it? I mean, those games with kind of instruction manuals that are about 200 pages long.
Yeah.
They I mean, it's not as bad as the North African campaign, but I mean they are pretty long. Having said that, there's another question from Ben Jones. And he says, I think my entire knowledge of English geography, aristocratic families, and certainly the Plantagenet family tree is from the board game Kingmaker. Always ended with stalemate until the Constable of the Tower of London got sent to Rye. Did you ever play Kingmaker?
No, I've seen it. I wanted it as a child, but I never got it.
So that's set against the War of the Roses.
Right, and, yeah, which is itself a colossal game, isn't it? I mean,
it is a colossal, yes.
Yeah, inspiration of Game of Thrones.
So you have to fight. But also you have plagues and you have peasants' revolts and you have to issue writs to summon parliament. So it's actually quite good. And
sounds
you can go
great.
Around collecting, you know, Warden of the Cinque Ports and Warden of the Northern Marches and things like that.
That's a card I've always wanted to have.
Fabulous game.
Yeah.
That whiles away a very pleasant 3 hours.
But you know, the terrible thing though, Tom, is when you get older. So I finished writing my most recent book about a month ago, and as my reward to myself, because obviously we're stuck at home in lockdown, as my reward to myself, I bought a video game for my computer, a strategy game that I could play while my wife was working. And it's called Kaiserreich. And it's a sort of offshoot of the Hearts of Iron games. So it's set in a world where Germany won the First World War, and it's set in the 1930s.
Oh, Dominic, that's your kind of dream.
It is. And you can choose any of these. I think there is some sort of slightly politically dodgy elements to it. But anyway, you can choose any country to control. So Britain has become a socialist republic. Austria-Hungary has become a kind of United States, a greater Austria. And I looked at this. I saw the map and I saw the sort of illustration. I thought, brilliant. I cannot wait. And I loaded it up and I deleted it about 10 minutes later. Because
why?
You have to produce a lot of steel. It's so complicated. I knew I'd never come to. And I started to read manuals online and people's advice about how to play it. And I just thought, I don't even understand what they're saying. And I aren't enough hours. Life is too short.
So what about the granddaddy of those kind of ones, which is Civilization?
Yeah, I played that. I have played that years ago.
So you begin with a tribe of hunter-gatherers in whatever it is, 4000 BC.
You do. You
and
create
you
your civilization
and you
from scratch.
Create civilization, and then you have to send a space rocket to Alpha Centauri. And you can be any one of a number of civilizations.
And what it does, which is what all these games do, is they sort of mirror all those books that you see, which will say, you know, these are the 10 building blocks of a successful nation state, or this is how democracies live and how they die. So I always think they're slightly a bit like business books. They try to sort of turn history into a set of distinct variables. And that's obviously how the game works. The game works on variables. And they say, these are the building blocks of civilization. Now create your own. And it is they are very addictive. But they're turning history into a kind of massive spreadsheet, aren't they, to some extent?
But they have to, don't they? Because otherwise it doesn't work. But it's very, very deterministic. I mean, it's kind of Marxism, absolutely
yes.
Power of 10. And it's also very, I mean, you know, you talked about decolonizing games. I mean, it establishes the emergence of European civilization as absolutely the norm that you
yeah.
have to industrialize.
And then you have to colonize everybody else.
And then you have to colonize everybody else. And that is the pattern of.
So there's an even better example of a game like that, Tom, which is I think the aficionados prefer to Civilization, which is called Europa Universalis, which I highly recommend. So Europa Universalis starts in about 1450. And you can play till the Battle of Waterloo. And what that does is you choose your country that exists in 1450 or so, and then the game follows history. So the Reformation happens and the 30 Years' War breaks out and set events follow each other. But also there are set technological and cultural developments, which are quite Eurocentric.
No, I really want to play this.
Which you have to, but you have to, you see, you get penalized if you don't embrace the printing press, or if you don't embrace colonization, then your stability cost is increased or whatever. So in other words, you have to follow the sort
down
of.
Down the funnel.
Yeah, down the funnel of history. Well, what's fun about that and what is instructive is I think it does reproduce in a way that maybe, you know, an academic seminar can't, the strategic dilemmas, shall we say, of leading a state. You know, if you are Prussia or you are Poland, in a weird way, kind of role-playing it, I think, does bring home the difficulties
yeah.
more so than reading it in the most high, you know, the most beautifully researched monograph. You know, there is a sense in which role-playing in that way does kind of carry a charge.
So those computer games, part of the fun is obviously absolutely being funneled down the spout of history. So to an extent, not being able to diverge from it is, you know, generates the fun. But then in other ways, that is precisely the fun, is being able to have Aztecs fight.
Yeah, absolutely.
Zulus or whatever.
That's the fun. The incongruity.
I've never been able to work out whether it's true or not. But this story that Gandhi in Civilization, who is incredibly pacifist and never declares war on anyone, when they reach the nuclear age, there's some glitch supposedly that makes him incredibly violent and declaring nuking everybody. And you can see that the part of the fun is having a set figures, set periods of history, set civilizations, and making them behave in wholly
exactly Martin Luther King becoming dictator of the United States or something would be
which
very
I suppose is a kind of counterfactual, the kind of counterfactuals that you do where you create alternative timelines in history.
Sort of silly. But the other kind of game that you have is a game that plunges you into history in a sort of individual level. So that's, say, the Assassin's Creed games or Call of Duty. Call of Duty is all about, is basically Second World War reenactment fantasy, isn't it? Yeah, it's about killing people. But Assassin's Creed is more interesting. And I'm surprised that you've never played it, Tom, because a lot of it is set in kind of ancient Egypt, ancient Greece, and all that sort of thing.
And the reason I haven't tried it is the same reason that I haven't taken up crack. I'm sure it's brilliant. Everybody says it's brilliant, but I know that I would never get anything done.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, I could sit house,
Your children are too old now. You see, my son is 9, so he's perfectly, you know, he's the right age to be really into all those, even though they're 10 to 18 certificate. We've just been fighting in the Peloponnesian War. Very entertaining.
Oh, God. I had to do an article in January about Vikings and why they were culturally cool, and that was on the back of the release of the new Assassin's Creed, which is set in the Viking world. And I thought, should I get it? And I almost did. Wow. And then I went and watched the opening loop on YouTube instead, and it was kind of like methadone. I got a vague sense of it, but I, you know, wasn't surrendering to it.
But see, all these games are quite political in a way because they're all about fighting. They're all about sort of individual agency. And the sort of, you know, there is this sort of conspiracy theory that underplays them all. So, you know, the world is being controlled by the Templars and stuff. So actually, it looks back to our podcast about conspiracy theories because the games present, as all games do, because they have to, there's a rule book and there's an intelligence that kind of underpins them and binds them all together. So actually what they miss from history is the sort of, as it were, the unexpected, the messiness, I suppose. They simplify history, don't they? They make it consumable.
But you still enjoy it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, of course. But games are part of human nature, aren't they? I mean, as you know, we love games, but also what Assassin's Creed does, for example, is it, you know, they would have in their game about, set in kind of Cleopatra's Egypt. They've got this incredibly faithful or painstaking reenactment of what Alexandria would look like. And you do get a set. I mean, I've never seen anything that's given and sometimes you can find online videos of people, you know, they've got ancient historians to comment. I suppose they haven't asked you, Tom. They get ancient historians to comment on the design of Athens or the design of Rome and to say, how accurate is this?
So I looked at London, Viking London.
Right.
I thought it inaccurate.
Did you? That's disappointing.
It was like a very fresh Roman ruin with lots of Roman statues standing everywhere. I think that's
and you don't think that's right. You don't think that's right.
No, I don't. I don't. But having said that, I thought it was amazing. I mean, you kind of feel that in a fantasy, that is what abandoned Roman London should look like.
Yeah,
and that must be part of fun because I don't want to play a computer game where everything is absolutely.
No, I suppose not.
You know, you want degree of creativity and experiment.
But the other extent to which they're political is that I look at slightly askance at the Vikings one because I believe the English are the baddies. So Alfred the Great,
King Alfred, is the baddie. Apparently. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, he's the main baddie. So
that's what decided me not to get it. I'm not lending my support to that. It's a French company, isn't it? So, you know, expect the worst.
They're Canadian, French-Canadian, I think. So they'd released a couple of very successful games set in the Crusades and in the Renaissance. Then they released the third one, which was set in the American War of Independence, and you played an American fighting the British, and their sales in Britain were much worse than anywhere else. That moment made me proud to be British to see that statistic, that people didn't want to...
I hope that people in Wessex will not be buying this anti-Alfredian nonsense.
But it would be interesting to find out whether people in Germany, for example, are ambivalent about playing war games in which the Germans are always painted as the... I mean, they're always the villains, aren't they? You're killing Nazis. I mean, that must be a weird thing to do if you're a teenage gamer in Frankfurt and you're basically engaged in shooting, you know, people who are mocked up versions of your great grandfather and his buddies.
Yeah.
Do you not think?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I do. I mean,
and it also raises the question that Alan Allport, who's a historian himself and a listener to the podcast, raised on Twitter about taste. He said, at what point do you cross the line? And do you think, I mean, the Vikings were incredibly brutal. They enslaved people, bashed their heads in with their axes or whatever. Do you think there's ever a taste issue, Tom?
Well, I think that's interesting. I mean, that is an interesting question, which touches on a much broader issue, which is when do atrocities and enslavement and imperial expansion, when does it cease to be a legitimate subject for entertainment?
Yeah, that's a really good question.
I think that is a huge question, and I think that that could be the theme of another episode where we discuss that issue. And I think that that is actually the perfect point on which to pack up the board game, put away the dice.
Leave it hanging, yeah.
Leave it hanging. So thanks ever so much. So see you next episode.
We'll see you next time. Tom has been crushed. I have conquered the board. I just wanted to get that in, actually. And yeah, we'll see you next time. We've got, I can't remember what we've got lined up for next week.
Persia. We've got Persia.
Persia. Great. Well, I'm really looking forward to that. What have the Persians ever done for us?
Yeah. Why Persia basically has invented everything. It's a great episode. Look forward to it. Bye.
All right. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.